John Henry Six Killer and his prisoner, Straight Arrow, had been underway for the better part of 2 hours when they crossed a stream. Straight Arrow stopped.
What are you stopping here for?
I never pass up a chance to fill my canteen with water.
You're going to pass it this time. Keep going.
John Henry knew why Straight Arrow wanted to stop. There were two men riding parallel with them. Stopping at the creek would give the men the opportunity to make their ambush. They rode on for another mile before Straight Arrow stopped again.
Why are you stopping here?
Can't you tell? My horse is going lame.
I don't see anything.
Maybe you can't see it, but he's favoring his right foreleg. I can feel it.
Keep going.
This is a good horse. If I ride him lame now, what am I going to do for a horse in the future?
You don't have a future.
We've got to stop, I tell you, and give my horse a rest.
John Henry looked over to his left without being obvious about it and saw the two riders slipping through a notch in the hills, moving so quietly and expertly that only someone specifically looking for them would have noticed.
All right. We'll stop here a few minutes.
There's no need now. I think he may have just picked up a rock in his shoe, but now he's thrown it. He's not limping anymore.
Evidently, Straight Arrow had also seen the same thing as John Henry, and now that the two men had gotten ahead of them, he wanted to ride on, leading John Henry into the ambush.
We'll stop here. I'm gonna have you wait while I check ahead.
You're going to have me wait here?
Yes.
Sure. You go ahead and check. I won't go anywhere.
Straight Arrow smiled broadly.
Oh, I know you won't.
About a minute later, Straight Arrow still sat his horse, now with his hands cuffed behind his back. The rope around his neck had been thrown over the limb of a tree and tied off. Should his horse decide to run away from under him, he would be hanged.
You can't leave me here like this, you son of a bitch!
I'd be quiet if I were you. You don't want to spook your horse now, do you?
John Henry left the trail he'd been following, then rode over to the trail where the two would-be ambushers rode. It didn't take him long to catch up with them. They were behind a rock outcropping, watching the path John Henry would have been coming on had he not stopped. He recognized them from seeing them in the saloon back in Verdigris, and he believed, based upon what Straight Arrow said, that they were Crater and Appleby. Though, of course, he didn't know which was which. Carrying his rifle at the ready, John Henry walked up behind them, stopping when he was less than 30 feet away.
What the hell is keeping them?
Don't be so damned anxious. They'll be here in a minute.
Straight Arrow won't.
What?
But I'm here now.
The two men whirled around.
Drop your guns and your holsters. You, take off your shirt.
What for?
John Henry raised the rifle to his shoulder and aimed at the man.
I'm not going to ask you again. Put your guns and holsters into the shirt and tie it up in a neat bundle for me.
Appleby complied.
Now get out of here.
The two men started toward the horses they had tied to a nearby tree.
Leave the horses. You're walking.
The hell you say? We're out here in the middle of nowhere. There ain't no way I'm gonna leave my horse.
You can walk out of here alive or stay here dead. I don't care which, but you're not going to ride out of here.
I think the son of a bitch means it, Crater.
Good thinking, Mr. Appleby.
What? How the hell do you know my name?
A medicine man told me.
You're lying.
Indians never lie. I thought you knew that.
Crater shook his head.
Let's get out of here.
John Henry watched the two men until they were out of sight. After that, he jacked all the shells out of the rifles, then slammed the rifle barrels against rocks until they were bent so badly they could never be fired again. That done, he untied the two horses, slapped them on the rump, and sent them running. When John Henry returned to Straight Arrow, he was sitting perfectly still, exactly as he'd been left. John Henry untied the rope from the tree, then recuffed Straight Arrow's hands in front so he could ride. When the two men rode into Tahlequah late that afternoon, the entire town was turned out to meet them.
Did they give you much of a fight, John Henry?
Hey, Straight Arrow, I'm glad they caught you, you murdering son of a bitch.
Straight Arrow gave no reaction to the taunts from those gathered alongside the street. Instead, he stared ahead, glumly. And when they reached the jail, Captain LaFlores stood on the porch to meet them.
Hello, Straight Arrow. Welcome to Tahlequah. Or in your case, I suppose I should say, welcome home.
You go to hell, LaFloris.
Oh, now is that any way to act toward the man who's going to be your host for a while? Huh? Or for at least until we hang you.
I hope you got something to eat in there. This son of a bitch ain't give me nothing to eat all day long.
Straight Arrow started toward the front door of the jailhouse, but Captain LaFloris reached out his hand to stop him.
Uh-oh, Straight Arrow. You won't be going in there.
What do you mean?
Boyette, take him over to the courtyard. Put him in the holding cell.
The holding cell? What do you mean, the holding cell? Don't I get a trial? You can't hang me without a trial.
You already had your trial. You were tried, convicted, and sentenced to be hanged before you escaped. There's no need to try you all over again.
The town of Emporia, Kansas, which lay in the forks of the Cottonwood and the Osho Rivers, was almost blanketed in the swirling dust kicked up by the heavy traffic of countless riders and wagons. The hitching rails all along the main street were full, and the livery stables and horse lots were jammed with saddled horses. Wagons, buckboards, and carts were parked everywhere there was space. Cowhands and frontiersmen mingled with the townspeople and a handful of soldiers from Fort Riley. Judge Levi Parsons was in town, meeting with Robert Stevens, John Scullin, and Otis Gunn. Parsons was president of the newly constituted Missouri, Kansas, and Texas Railway Company, already coming to be known as the Katy Line. Stevens was his general manager, Scullin his superintendent of track, and Gunn his construction manager. The group included other men Parsons had invited who might be potential investors. Stevens gave the first report.
Since I have taken over as general manager, good progress has been made. The month before I assumed this position, only 5 miles of track were laid. Now we have regularly scheduled freight and passenger service running from Emporia to Junction City.
Judge Parsons nodded.
Thank you, Bob. You've done a very good job. But as you, Mr. Scullin, and Mr. Gunn already know, this is only the start.
Parsons turned to the investors.
Gentlemen, after much negotiation, the Cherokee have granted permission for a railroad to be built through their land. I propose to push the Katy down through Indian Territory and all the way through Texas to the Mexican border. This will open Kansas City, St. Louis, and Chicago to the lucrative cattle shipping market.
One gentleman shifted in his seat.
Judge Parsons, I have been told that only one railroad can proceed through the nations.
That is true, and I intend for the Katy to be that railroad.
But what about the border tier line? Isn't it also building south to the Kansas border?
It is.
Then how is it to be resolved as to which railroad will have the right to go through Indian Territory?
The right of passage through Indian Territory, gentlemen, will be awarded to the railroad which first reaches the border between Kansas and the Indian Territory.
Well, then what you were saying is we're in a race.
That is exactly what I'm saying. And I'll say it again. It is a race that I intend for the Katy to win.
Within a matter of days after the Katy Railroad meeting in Emporia, James Joy convened a meeting of the Border Tier Line in Kansas City. James Joy owned several railroads, including the Border Tier Railroad, the line he intended to push from Kansas City down to the Kansas and Indian Territory border.
In no way do I intend to let that upstart Katy line beat us. Parsons has grandiose schemes of eventually connecting to the Transcontinental Railroad to give him connection to the West Coast, much like ours. He also wants to build through to Chicago. We are already there, and with our railroad going through Chicago, we have connections to New York and Philadelphia as well. By opening our railroad through Indian Territory, then through Texas to Mexico, we will control the most important railroads in the world. And when that time comes, using only the Joy Lines, one will be able to traverse this nation from the Atlantic to the Pacific and from Canada to Mexico. And here's the thing, gentlemen. By necessity, Judge Parsons will be working on a shoestring budget. I, on the other hand, intend to put as much money as is necessary into making certain that our railroad is the first one to the Indian Territory border.
Mr. Joy, why don't you just buy the Katy out? That way there will be no need for a race to the border. You will have the only railroad.
Why should I waste the money to buy him out? All we have to do is beat him to the border and his railroad will be worthless. Then, if I really wanted it, I could pick it up for pennies on the dollar. No, gentlemen, as I said, I intend to beat him to the border.
Joy reached for his glass and held it up.
Gentlemen, I give you the Joy Lines from coast to coast and from Canada to Mexico.
The Joy Lines!
Although white settlers were not allowed in Indian territory, they could be there under the classification of traders. And the term traders covered a broad spectrum, including hotel keepers, livery stable operators, barbers, draymen, grocers, and suppliers of saddles, carbines, ammunition, wagon tongues, kitchen knives, sunbonnets, calico dresses, tobacco, and snuff. Whites could not own land, but they could lease land from the Indians on a year-by-year basis, so that, in essence, they did own it. Also, many whites married Indians, thus becoming members of the tribes and granted full rights of citizenship within the Indian Territory. Indians and whites alike turned out when John Henry came riding into Tahlequah with two bodies thrown belly down over their saddles. Technically, the Indian police had no jurisdiction over the whites who lived with them, so there were, in addition to the Indian police, white lawmen, deputy U.S. marshals who handled crimes involving whites. Because the two belly-down outlaws, the Carnes brothers, were white, John Henry took them to the office of the white deputy U.S. marshal, who, already alerted, stood out in front of his office.
What do we have here, Six Killer?
These men murdered Harold and Mary Two Hills.
John Henry swung down from his saddle and stood, holding the reins to his horse, Ironheart.
Well now, we aren't ever gonna know that, are we? They didn't get their time in court.
That was their decision, Marshal. I attempted to bring them in, but they wouldn't have it that way. They shot at me, so I shot back.
Are they white or Indian? You brought them here, so I'm assuming they're white.
Yes, they're white.
Then what were you doing trying to bring them in the first place? They are white men. You are an Indian policeman. You have no authority over them.
The Indian half of me tracked them, Marshal. But it's the white half of me that brought them in. You might say that I was making a citizen's arrest.
Who are they?
Dennis stepped down from the porch to examine them.
You'll recognize them.
Dennis grabbed one of the bodies by the hair and lifted its head.
Son of a bitch. Sterile Carnes.
He stepped over to the other horse and examined that body as well.
And his brother Abe.
I believe they're wanted men.
You're damn right they're wanted. Not only here in the nations, but in about half the states in the West. And you say they murdered Harold Two Hills and his wife?
Yes. I tracked them from the Two Hills Mercantile to Cootie's Bluff.
That was quite a job of tracking. Probably headed for Kansas, I'd say.
That's what I figured.
Well, I can't say I'm sorry to see him brought in belly down like this. But there's going to have to be a hearing as to whether or not you killing them was justified.
In whose court? Indian court or white man's court?
White man's court in Fort Smith.
When's the hearing?
More than likely within the next 2 weeks. I'm not going to have to come and get you, am I, Six Killer? You'll show up?
I'll be there.
Leaving the marshal's office, John Henry went to the trading post and bought bacon, beans, coffee, cornmeal, and flour. Then he took his purchases to his mother's house.
John Henry.
His mother saw the packages he was carrying.
John Henry, you don't have to bring me gifts when you come. Just having you here is gift enough.
That's not it. I thought maybe you would make some beans and cornbread for me.
Well, of course I will, but I'll have to put them on to soak. It'll be tomorrow before I can fix them.
That's fine, Etsy. I can wait.
His mother smiled at his use of the Cherokee term for mother.
Sasha has been over to see me several times.
Has she?
She is such a sweet girl. She's been a big help to me.
I'm glad.
She thinks a lot of you.
I think a lot of her as well.
So?
What do you mean, so?
John Henry, you know what I mean. You aren't getting any younger, you know. Most men your age, many who are younger, are married. Don't you think that's something you should consider?
It wouldn't be fair to Sasha for me to take her as a wife.
Why would you say such a thing? What isn't fair to the poor girl is to keep her dangling like this.
I'm not keeping her dangling. I've told her that my job will keep me away a lot of the time.
Do you think she wouldn't understand that?
And there is always a chance that...
That what? That you could be killed?
Yes.
John Henry, do you think I didn't worry about your father and you when you went away to war?
I'm sure you did, but I can't...
But nothing. You're not giving Sasha credit for being the strong woman she is. If a wife can handle her husband going to war, then a wife can certainly handle her husband being a policeman. Besides, if something like that is going to happen, it's going to happen. Who would ever have thought that James could be killed as he was? James wasn't a policeman. He was a rancher and a businessman.
Etsy, Mom, I know that you want only what's best for me. And I know that you think Sasha would make a good wife. I think she would too. I'm just not ready to make that move yet.
Let me ask you this, John Henry. Suppose Sasha married another man. It could happen, you know. She's a beautiful and intelligent young woman with much to offer any man who might want to take her as his wife. Suppose that happened. How would you feel?
John Henry was quiet for a long moment.
I would hope that it would be a happy marriage for her.
But you wouldn't be all that happy about it, would you? You can't keep her dangling forever. I'll invite her over for beans and cornbread tomorrow.
Mom, I'd rather you didn't do that.
I'm not inviting her for you, John Henry. She's my friend. I am inviting her for myself.
Even though John Henry thought he would be uncomfortable with Sasha as a dinner guest, he actually found he enjoyed her company. Sasha was all smiles as she shared some good news with her hosts.
I have been hired as a school teacher.
Oh, Sasha, that's wonderful. But does that mean you'll be leaving Sequoia?
No, that is the best part. I'll be staying right here.
Elizabeth glanced over at John Henry and thought she saw relief on his face that Sasha would not be leaving.
You make the best beans, Elizabeth. You will have to teach me how to make them.
There's nothing to it. You just soak them overnight, then cook them about 5 hours with a big piece of fat pork, some onions, and a few cut-up potatoes. They're John Henry's favorite, you know.
Sasha looked over toward John Henry and was surprised to see him crumbling some cornbread into a glass of milk.
What are you doing?
I like cornbread and milk.
I've never heard of such a thing. I must try that.
Believe me, dear, all you will be doing is wasting cornbread. You won't like it. Honestly, I don't know how John Henry can eat it that way.
Sasha broke up a piece of cornbread into her milk, then spooned some of it into her mouth.
Oh, this is delicious. I don't know why I've never heard of this before.
John Henry looked at her in surprise.
Wait a minute, you mean you actually like it? You aren't saying that just to be nice to me?
No, I really like it.
Elizabeth started to clear away the dishes from the table. Sasha stood quickly.
Let me help.
Oh, there's no need for you to help. Why don't you two young people go into the living room where you can visit? I'll take care of this.
My mother is about as subtle as a sledgehammer.
She means well.
John Henry and Sasha went into the living room. He sat in a chair rather than on the sofa. Though Sasha said nothing, John Henry could tell by the expression on her face that she would have preferred he sit on the sofa so she could join him.
My mother is trying to do something.
I know what she's trying to do. She has mentioned it to me several times.
How do you feel about that?
I feel that you are the one who has to make a decision, not your mother.
Sasha, please don't think that I'm averse to the idea of marriage. I'm like everyone else. I want to find a good wife and have a family. And of all the people I know, I've never met a woman who I think would make a better wife than you. It's just that, well, for a while anyway.
You want to continue being a hero?
Well, I wouldn't say that.
Why not? You are a hero, John Henry. Don't you know that every young boy in the territory looks up to you and considers you a hero? But I'm not surprised. You have always been my hero, ever since the day you rescued me from Willie Buck.
Anyone who might have come along that day would have done the same thing. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time.
Like Willie Buck, Hector Crow Dog returned from the war, unable or unwilling to become a law-abiding citizen. While riding with Quantrill's raiders, Crow Dog had developed a taste for murder and robbery, and it was a taste he continued to satisfy when the war was over. John Henry had not seen Crow Dog since the war, because Crow Dog had not returned to Indian territory. He carried on most of his nefarious activity in Kansas. That activity soon made him one of the most wanted outlaws in all of Kansas. He was waiting at a bridge outside Coffeyville for the night stagecoach to Sedan. The coach had running lamps with mirror reflectors that cast twin light beams forward. The lamps helped Crow Dog track the coach as it approached, but he knew they would not be putting out enough light to see him unless he was standing in the road right in front of them. Just as it slowed to pull up onto the bridge, Crow Dog jumped up from the side of the road.
Hold it right there! Throw down the mail pouch!
The driver stopped, but the guard jumped up and pointed his shotgun at Crow Dog. But the shotgun misfired.
Ha!
The flame pattern of Crow Dog's two shots painted the side of the coach like two flashes of lightning. Moses Garrett was one of the passengers inside the coach. Garrett was a deputy U.S. Marshal, but tonight he was riding as a passenger on the way back to Sedan. As soon as he heard the demand to stop, he knew immediately what was going on, and putting his finger across his lips to caution the others to be quiet, he slipped out of the door on the opposite side of the coach from the robber. With his pistol in hand, he came around the back of the coach just as Hector Crow Dog climbed up to retrieve the mail pouch. Crow Dog had put his pistol back in the holster, and so intent was he on the task of getting the mail pouch, he didn't see Garrett come up behind him.
Come back down here.
Crow Dog started to move his hand toward his pistol, but stopped when he heard Garrett cocking his own pistol.
Oh, yeah. Go for your gun. It'll be a lot easier taking you back dead than it will alive.
When Crow Dog reached the ground, even before he turned around, Garrett brought his pistol down hard on Crow Dog's head.
Mr. Parkinson, could you step out here and help me load him into the luggage boot? I'll handcuff him in there.
Hector Crow Dog's crime spree had come to an end, and because he had stolen U.S. mail, it became a federal crime. Crow Dog was tried in Judge Isaac Parker's court, and despite the long-ago promise of the medicine man that he would never be hanged, he was found guilty and sentenced to that very fate. Thus it was that when John Henry arrived at Fort Smith for Straight Arrow's hearing, he got there just in time to see Crow Dog about to be hanged. Crow Dog stood on the gallows, his legs tied together, his arms lashed to his side. Deputy U.S. Marshal Garrett stood beside the prisoner, sweating under the hot sun. There, several hundred spectators stood in the same sun looking up at the gallows. There was one black cloud in the sky, but it wasn't large enough to provide any relief from the sun. Outside the walls of the fort, over 100 buckboards, spring wagons, and saddle horses bore witness to the distance so many had traveled to watch this hanging. Several arrived the day before and spent the night on the ground so they would be here to see the hanging of Crow Dog, the man who would become infamous for murdering and plundering in Kansas, Arkansas, Colorado, and the Indian Territory.
Look at all those dumb people standing there in the hot sun, sweating like a run-out horse.
You're standing in the same sun.
Yeah, but you forget, I ain't gonna be here much longer.
Crow Dog was of muscular build, though he was quite short, standing only about 5 feet 4 inches tall. As he looked out over the crowd, he was surprised to see John Henry.
Well, look here! If it's not my old friend, John Henry Six Killer. Come to watch your old friend die, did you, John Henry?
Looks like I got here just in time, Hector.
Hey, John Henry, do you remember I told you once I wasn't never gonna hang?
I remember.
Oh, that's because Sam Blackhorse told me I wasn't never gonna hang. You remember him, don't you? The old medicine man?
I remember him.
Yeah, well, I wish I could see that old son of a bitch now. I paid him $1 to tell me I wasn't gonna hang, and here I am about to. I'd get my money back, that's what I'd do. Of course, that dollar wouldn't do me much good now, would it? Still, I'd like to have it in my pocket when I swing. Maybe when I get to hell, I could buy myself a nice cold beer.
You got any last words, Crow Dog?
I come here to die.
I didn't come here to make a speech.
Crow Dog looked at Garrett, then out at the crowd, which consisted of men, women, and children, white, black, and Indian. He looked at John Henry again and smiled.
Oh, I'll bet you wish you was standing up here so you could just pull the lever, don't you, John Henry?
You put yourself there, Hector, when you killed that driver and a shotgun guard.
Suppose I did, but it seemed like the thing to do at the time. I am tired. Today, I'm going home.
Goodbye.
Crow Dog turned to Garrett.
Say, didn't you say you was gonna hang me?
That's what I intend to do.
Then what the hell are you waiting around for?
You don't want to disappoint all these people now, do you?
They came to see a good show, and I'm the star. So let's quit all this fooling around and get it done.
Garrett looked over at the hangman and nodded. The hangman pulled the lever. It was an eerie coincidence. A clap of thunder shook the earth. The black cloud that had been hanging above the fort, not large enough to blot out the sun, shot down a bolt of lightning. The lightning struck Crow Dog as he fell, causing sparks to fly from his body. Many were stunned, and some of the women swooned. Hector Crow Dog's body hung at the end of the rope, still smoking from the lightning bolt.
I'll be damned.
He shook his head.
Hector Crow Dog was killed by the lightning bolt before it reached the end of the drop. The old medicine man was right after all.
Judge Isaac Charles Parker was 35 years old when he took the bench in federal court in Fort Smith, making him the youngest federal judge in America. Despite the heat of the day, he was wearing a suit, vest, and tie. Dark-haired and with a dark and well-trimmed Van Dyke beard, he sat behind the bench without robes because this was a hearing, not a trial. There was no jury present. Howard Gibson, the federal prosecutor in the United States Court for the Western District of Arkansas, rose from his chair at the prosecutor's table.
Your Honor, the United States government, by these presents, makes the case that John Henry Six Killer has exceeded his authority in apprehending two white men, Daryl and Abraham Carnes. That is a felony violation. And in the course of this felony violation, John Henry Six Killer did shoot and kill both men. In that they were killed during the commission of a felony, a case could also be made for first-degree murder.
The judge eyed Gibson.
Are you asking that Mr. Six Killer be tried for first-degree murder?
No, Your Honor. At the most, I would ask for unlawful manslaughter. However, I am willing to withhold even that charge if the defendant would agree to plea to the unlawful exceeding of his authority.
Are you willing to make that plea, Mr. Six Killer?
I am not, Your Honor. For such a plea would necessitate my removal as a policeman in the Cherokee Nation.
Very well, Mr. Gibson. You may make your case.
Deputy Marshal Dennis rose from his seat in the gallery.
Your Honor, if I may.
Yes, Deputy Marshal, what is it?
I made a proposal to the U.S. Marshal that he agrees with, and with your cooperation, it could take care of this situation.
And what is that proposal?
I propose, Your Honor, that you swear in John Henry Six Killer as a U.S. Marshal. That way he'll be able to deal with criminals, whether they be Indian or white.
Would you be willing to serve as a U.S. Marshal in my court?
Yes, Your Honor. I would consider it a great honor to serve as a U.S. Marshal in your court.
That won't do, Your Honor. We are dealing with a case that happened 2 weeks ago.
Suppose we make Mr. Six Killer's appointment retroactive.
Retroactive?
Yes, we could appoint him as a U.S. Marshal effective 1 month ago. That way, his tracking, apprehending, and shooting in the act of the apprehending would no longer be an issue.
Your Honor, in that case, the prosecution will drop all charges.
John Henry Six Killer, raise your right hand, please, and repeat after me. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of United States Marshal and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, so help me God.
John Henry repeated the oath.
Marshal Six Killer, you are now an officer of the United States Court for the Western District of Arkansas. Don't do anything to embarrass us.
Thank you, Your Honor. Marshal Dennis, Mr. Gibson, I will do all I can to see that none of you regret this appointment.
Later that day, Marshal Sarber, chief federal marshal of the district, and all the deputy marshals celebrated John Henry's appointment.
You're one of us now. You're a federal commission, which means you aren't limited to the Indian Territory. You can go anywhere in the country and make arrests.
That's good to know.
But because you are appointed by the U.S. Court for the Western District of Arkansas, you will bring your prisoners to Fort Smith.
I understand.
By the way, you do know what they say about Fort Smith, don't you?
No, what do they say?
There's no Sunday west of St. Louis, and there's no God west of Fort Smith.
It didn't take John Henry long to get his first assignment. On the very day he was sworn in as a U.S. Marshal, he was sent out to bring in, dead or alive, Vernon Simmons, Pete Fuller, and Injun Joe Pipestem, whose failed bank robbery left seven dead in what the paper soon called Carnage in Coffeyville, Kansas. John Henry started his hunt in the Coffeyville office of Sheriff Miller.
Yeah, I know exactly where they are. They hang out around Bird Creek down in the Nations. They know as long as they stay down there, there ain't nothing I can do about them, because they're out of my jurisdiction. Now, you being a U.S. Marshal, though, that means you can go down there. You know the Bird Creek area?
Yes.
John Henry knew Bird Creek like he knew the back of his hand. He had fished and hunted there from the time he was a boy.
Let it be known that I'm looking for them. Let it be said that when I find them, I will take them back so that Judge Parker can hang them. If enough people know this, soon the men I am looking for will know it as well. And I won't have to find them because they'll come looking for me.
By John Henry's second night out, he knew his plan had worked. Three men trailed him. He knew also they would not confront him directly, but would make their move at night. He drank his coffee and ate a piece of jerky. Then he laid out his bedroll. He put the piece of canvas down, then the blanket, then the saddle, trailing the stirrups down along the blanket. Finally, he covered the saddle with another blanket and put his hat at the head. When John Henry was through, he moved about 20 yards away, slipped down into a little depression, and looked back upon his handiwork. The fire burned low, and the area smelled of coffee, and his horse stood quietly in the dark. His hat on the bedroll covered what appeared to be the head, while the saddle gave the blanket the dimensions of a sleeping man. Satisfied with the illusion he had created, John Henry settled back to wait. It was Injun Joe who discovered the campfire first. He found it not by sight, but by smell.
I smell smoke. There's a campfire on the other side of the water.
The three riders crossed the creek, moving as slowly and as quietly as they could. Fuller stopped.
Would you look at that? Why the hell would he build a fire like that? It's almost like he wants us to find him.
Fuller shook his head.
Nah, it's because he's looking for us. And didn't figure on us looking for him.
We done it, boys. We got him. He's a cocky son of a bitch, ain't he? I mean, building a fire like he don't have no fear of nothing in the world.
Yeah, well, why don't we just see how cocky this son of a bitch can be with a couple of bullets in his gut?
After dismounting, the three men tied off their horses.
You two stay back here.
Why?
He belongs to me.
Be careful. That's John Henry's six killer.
What is that supposed to mean?
I know John Henry's six killer. He will be a hard man to kill.
How hard can it be? He's asleep now.
It is said that when he sleeps, he can still see. Many have tried to kill him. All have failed.
No offense, Injun Joe, but you're talking about Injuns that have tried to kill him. And Injuns like to do things that's honorable. Now me, I don't give a damn about being honorable. I just want the son of a bitch dead, and it won't bother me none at all to shoot the bastard while he's asleep.
Yeah, well, quit gabbing about it and do it. As long as the son of a bitch end up dead, I don't care how you kill him.
Simmons and Injun Joe waited by the river as Fuller started toward the campfire, a small, dim blaze that was now some 50 yards away. It had been a long, tiring trail. As a result, John Henry, who was tired, dozed off several times during the night. But even while he was asleep, he was alert. When he heard a boot scrape over a pebble near the campfire, John Henry was instantly awake. By the light of the moon, John Henry saw someone approaching the sleeping saddle. He raised his rifle, watched, and waited. The night intruder pulled his pistol out and pointed it toward the bedroll. He took careful aim. The muzzle flash of his pistol lit up the night.
Vernon! Vernon, I got him!
Sorry, friend, but you missed.
What the hell?
Fuller spun around. John Henry returned fire, using the flame pattern of Fuller's muzzle blast as his target. Simmons scanned the campsite for Fuller.
Pete! Pete, what's happening?
He's not going to answer you. He's dead. I think you and Injun Joe Pipestem had better come on in and give yourselves up.
Like hell we will!
John Henry heard, but could not see, the two men running over rocky ground. He knew when they hit the creek because he heard water splashing. He looked toward the sound, trying to see them, and though he couldn't, he could see the little fluorescent feathers of white water kicked up by their feet as they splashed across the shallow stream. John Henry fired a couple of times in the general direction of the white splashes, but the two were too far away, and it was too dark for him to have a real target. Once Simmons and Injun Joe reached the other side of the creek, the white splashes disappeared, and John Henry could no longer see them.
Thanks, boys.
John Henry had not been able to track them when he was first given the mission of bringing them in, but he could track them now because he was able to pick up their tracks from the creek. Long before he got there, John Henry could see the community of Doster. The tracks of the two men he was following had led him here to this little town that lay baking under the sun, hot, dry, dusty, and as brittle as tumbleweed. He urged the two horses, the one he was riding and the one he was leading, forward. The horse he was leading was carrying Pete, belly down across the saddle. If the horse had any reaction to its rider being dead, he didn't show it. The buildings in the town had collected the day's heat and were now giving it back in waves, so the Doster seemed to shimmer as he approached. A dust devil sprouted in front of him, propelled by a wind that felt as if it were blowing straight from the fires of hell. A jackrabbit popped up, ran for several feet, then darted under a dusty clump of fescue sedge. Doster amounted to a one-street town with a dozen or more ramshackle buildings that fronted the street. The unpainted wood of the few buildings was turning gray and splitting. Pitching poles lined either side of the street, and the horses tied to them nodded and stamped at the flies. There was no railroad coming into the town, but there was a stagecoach station with a schedule board announcing the arrival and departure of two stagecoaches per week. The town appeared isolated, inbred, and stagnant. John Henry rode past the buildings, checking each of them over as he passed. He noted a rooming house, a livery, a smithies, and a general store that said drugs, meats, and goods on its high false front. A hotel and restaurant stood baking in the sun, and of course, the ubiquitous saloon. This one called the Kansas Prairie Saloon. Across the street from the saloon, he spied the city marshal's office. He rode up to the hitching rail in front of the jail, dismounted, then looked up and down the street. He knew that coming into town with a body thrown over a horse would attract some attention, and evidently it did. He heard a door slam, and across the street, he saw an isinglass shade come down on an upstairs window of the hotel. John pushed open the door to the marshal's office. There was no one at the desk, but he saw someone sleeping on the bunk of one of the three cells, the lone occupant of the jail. The door to that cell stood open. John Henry had left the office door open as he entered. A gust of hot wind caught him.
What?
The man in the cell sat up on the bunk and saw John Henry standing just outside the cell.
Who are you? What do you want?
I'm looking for the town marshal.
Yeah? Well, you found him. I'm Marshal Dawes.
You're taking a chance, aren't you, Marshal Dawes? Sleeping in the cell, I mean? What if someone came in here and slammed the door shut on you?
I got the keys. What are you looking for me for?
Marshal, I'm United States Marshal Six Killer, and I...
Six Killer? Is that an Indian name?
Yes, I'm Cherokee.
You don't look like no Indian.
My mother is what?
Marshal Dawes stroked his jaw and stared at John Henry.
U.S. Marshal, huh? Well, what brings you to Doster, Marshal?
I've got a body for you.
A body? Where?
Belly down, across his horse. He's tied up out front.
Who is it?
John Henry saw a poster with Pete Fuller's name and picture, and he tore it down.
This man.
The bald-headed and overweight town marshal came out of the cell, poking his shirt down into his trousers.
The hell you say? Pete Fuller, huh? He's a bad one. Did you kill him?
Yes.
Well, good riddance, I say. What do you want me to do with him?
Get a notary to validate who it is, and get him buried.
What? You want the town to bury him? Who's gonna pay for that? Maybe you didn't notice, but this town ain't all that large. We don't have a lot of, disposable income.
You can keep his horse intact. That should cover it.
All right. That seems about right. What are you going to do now? You'll be going back down into the nations?
Nope. The other two men who are with Fuller are here in town now. I'm going after them.
There's two more of them, you say?
Yes. Vernon Simmons and Injun Joe Popstem.
Damn.
Marshal Dawes' eyes opened wide.
That's a couple of bad ones. And they're here, you say, in my town? How do you know they're here?
Because I tracked them here. And I intend to arrest them and take them back to Judge Parker to be hanged.
Hanging Judge Parker?
Dawes nodded.
Yes, sir. You take them boys back to him and he'll hang them all right. Would you be wanting... That is, are you asking me to come help you arrest them?
No.
Well, that's good. Don't get me wrong. I mean, if I thought you really needed help, I'd come along with you. Though I don't know how legal that would be. I mean, me being nothing but a town marshal and them two boys wanted by the state and federal government, well, it means I ain't really got no right to be messing with them.
I'll handle them myself.
Well, if they're in town, it's a guarantee that they'll be down at the saloon. Either that or in the cat house, which turns out to be the same thing, since a couple of the girls that's working there is the town's only whores.
Injun Joe hustled up to Vernon Simmons at the bar.
John Henry Six Killer is here. He just rode in down at the marshal's office. He'll be coming down here next.
What's he doing up here? He's an Injun policeman, ain't he?
I think that's true.
Then I ain't worried about him. He's got no authority over us here.
I think for a man like Six Killer, it won't matter whether he has the authority or not.
Yeah, maybe you're right. All right, then. We'll be waiting for him. Start blasting away as soon as he sets foot on the porch.
Vernon and Injun Joe both moved up to the front door and, with guns drawn, looked down toward the marshal's office. John Henry eyed Marshal Dawes' office.
You have a back way out of this building?
Yeah, I do, but I keep it locked.
Unlock it. I just as soon not be seen going down to the saloon. I take it the saloon has a back door.
Yeah, and it isn't locked because the privy's out back.
Thanks.
The saloon's back door was shielded by the piano, which wasn't being played at the time. That allowed John Henry a moment to peruse the room. He saw three men standing on one side of the bar and the bartender on the other side. Two other men sat at one of the tables, and a man and a bar girl sat at another table. Three more tables stood empty. Everyone in the saloon stared at the two men standing up front, just inside the swinging batwing doors. Both held pistols as they looked outside. John Henry took a few more steps into the saloon, so far not noticed by any of the others, all of whom had their attention riveted upon the two armed men standing up by the front door. He raised his pistol and pointed it at the two men.
Vernon Simmons, Injun Joe, drop your guns.
Simmons spun around.
What the hell?
Don't do it.
John Henry cocked his pistol, aiming it directly at Vernon. Injun Joe was the first to drop his pistol and put his hands up. Then, seeing that he would have to face John Henry alone, Vernon dropped his pistol as well.
That's real smart of you boys. Now let's take a little walk down to the jail.
You got him, did you? Good. I was getting a little nervous, waiting, wondering what was going on. I was about to come down there and offer you my help if you needed it.
As you can see, I didn't need it.
So, what do we do with them now?
We'll keep them here in your jail until Fort Smith sends a prisoner transport van for them.
Here? You're gonna keep them here? Do you think that's wise? I mean, them being federal prisoners and all? It's just a small city jail.
Where else would you suggest I keep them? In a hotel?
No, I guess it'll be okay to keep them here.
I'll sleep in the next cell.
Yeah, that'll probably be a pretty good idea. I mean, in case they try to escape or something.
Well, you'll be all right with them until I get back?
Get back? Get back from where?
I put in a lot of miles today. Hot, dry, dusty miles. And I intend to have a beer.
Well, I thought Indians couldn't drink.
Indians can't. That's all right. Just means more beer for the white half of me.
Milton Simmons scowled at Abner Turner.
What do you mean my brother is in jail?
I mean he's in jail. Him and that Injun he runs with.
Injun Joe?
Yeah. Well, they was both in here, but that Injun Marshal, the one they call Six Killer, took them both down to the jailhouse.
He's just one man. I can't see one man being able to do that. Not with Vernon and Injun Joe both.
Vernon and Injun Joe didn't have no choice in it. Six Killer come in through the back door with his gun already drawn. If Vernon or the Injun had tried anything, he'd have shot them both.
Well, why didn't you do something?
There weren't nothing I could have done except maybe get the two of them killed. You didn't want that, did you?
Well, I can tell you right now, my brother ain't going to stay in no jail.
Son of a bitch. There he is now.
Turner nodded, but did not point at the tall, powerfully built man who had just come in. John Henry stepped up to the bar, and the bartender moved down to him.
Did you get the two boys put away for the night?
I did.
Well, what do you have?
John Henry took a nickel out of his pocket and put it on the bar.
No, sir. This first beer is on me. I figure putting away those two characters is worth a beer in anybody's saloon.
You, the engine standing at the bar. What are you doing up here with the white people? Don't you know engines aren't welcome up here? Why don't you go back down to the nations where you belong?
Why don't you have a beer on me?
I don't want a beer on you, you son of a bitch. You're the one who just put my brother in jail.
John Henry turned toward him and studied him for a long moment.
You don't appear to be an Indian, so I'm guessing Vernon Simmons is your brother.
You're guessing right.
What can I do for you, Mr. Simmons?
You can let my brother and Injun Joe out of jail.
I don't think so. Your brother and Mr. Pipestem murdered six people. I'm taking them back to Fort Smith to hang.
No, you ain't gonna do that.
Milton Simmons moved his hand in such a way as to take in Turner.
As you can see, there's two of us and only one of you. And you ain't standing behind us the way you was when you got the drop on my brother.
From behind the bar came the sound of hammers being pulled back on a shotgun. And looking toward the bar, John Henry saw the bartender pointing the shotgun at Simmons and Turner.
You're sounding most quarrelsome, Mr. Simmons. And I don't like quarrelsome people in my saloon.
You think you're scaring me with that scatter gun? I know damn well you ain't willing to shoot me just because I'm quarrelsome.
Maybe he isn't, but I am.
You are what?
I'm willing to shoot you.
Abner Turner grinned.
You ain't thinking very straight, are you? You was behind Vernon and Injun Joe. You're right here in front of us.
Shut up, Turner.
Milton continued to stare at John Henry.
I think the son of a bitch means it.
I do mean it. Now drop your gun belts.
Milton hesitated.
Now, do what the marshal says.
The bartender raised the shotgun to his shoulder. First Milton and then Turner unbuckled their pistol belts.
Now step back away from him.
Look here, Marshal. This is getting a little out of hand now. Like you said, let's just stop this now. I reckon I'll take that beer after all.
John Henry nodded at the bartender, who put his shotgun away, then brewed two beers and set them on the bar. Suddenly, Milton spun away from the bar toward John Henry. He had a pistol in his hand and an evil smile on his face.
Did you think I was really dumb enough to drop my gun unless I had another? Turner, pick up the other guns.
With a big smile on his face, Turner retrieved the two belts and holsters. He strapped his on, then pulled his pistol and pointed it at John Henry, holding it there as Milton started to strap on his own gun.
Now here's what we're gonna do.
Milton put his second pistol on the bar as he strapped on his holster.
We're going down to the jail, and you are going to turn my brother and Injun Joe loose.
You wouldn't listen to me, would you? You could have enjoyed your beer, then walked out of here free men. Now you're both under arrest.
What? Why, you dumb son of a bitch. We got the drop on you, and you're telling us that we're under arrest?
You have your choice. You can either come down to the jail with me now, or...
Or what?
I'll kill you both.
Let me get this straight. Your gun is in your holster. Turner and I are both holding our pistols on you, but you are going to kill us both. Is that right?
Yes.
Then, Injun, you'd better start killing, because I've had about enough of you. I'm going to count to three, and if you ain't started toward the jail to let my brother and Injun Joe out, you're the one that's going to get killed. One, two...
John Henry drew so fast that his hand was a blur.
You didn't let me get to three.
Yeah, sometimes a cheat.